with a few colleagues. They wanted to launch an independent muckraking newspaper. And they had two desks, two computers, and just about that. And they launched. And it is a survival, a testament to the ability to survive if you're a bold, creative editor, which I knew he was. What I didn't understand was how he would become an advocate for freedom of the press against all odds. As you mentioned, Amy, six of his journalists have been killed in the line of duty. One of them, Anna Politkovskaya, was murdered in October 2006, ironically, sadly, just a day before Dima Muratov received the Nobel Prize in 2006, October 7. What he's become is the possibility of doing investigative journalism in Russia today is very dangerous. It's not just his journalists. There are others who have been killed, Yeltsin era, Putin era, and there's a culture of impunity, of failure to hold account those who are killing freedom of the press. On the other hand, Novaya has done some of the best independent muckraking investigative journalism about abuse of power. They, in fact, covered Putin's abuses of corruption, the public officials' corruption, even before Navalny circulated his videos. Right-wing extremism, one of their young journalists, Yelena Milashina, covered the persecution of the LGBT community in Chechnya. So it's a dangerous, very dangerous profession. But Novaya has not only persevered, endured, but has younger journalists wanting to work for it. It has numbers that all of us would envy, about 30 million in social media each month, and 8 to 11 million readers come to its website. Its print edition is smaller, but a younger generation is coming to it. So it survives, and I think this prize will both give it protection, but ironically will raise the question of foreign funds. We can talk about that, but there has been a trend of repressive media legislation. For example, if you take foreign money, being labeled foreign agent. So that will be interesting to see what happens. But I suspect this prize, for the most part, will give Novaya more protection.
And that point is something Dmitry Muratov raised. Also, your response to those who suggested Alexei Navalny should have been awarded the prize and that Muratov was really a compromise by the Nobel Committee so as not to offend the Kremlin. He himself said Alexei Navalny should have gotten it.
So Alexei Navalny, I think, he's an anti-corruption activist. He's also a political figure. I mean, he received 32% in the Moscow mayoral elections a few years ago. Novaya has covered the persecution of Alexei Navalny, very comprehensive coverage. But I do think of Navalny is not he's a internet anti-corruption activist, and he also got very involved in the electoral scene in a way that Novaya steps back and reports, has its positions, obviously, but is honest about them. So I think there should be a calling out of the repression of the Putin administration vis-a-vis journalists, but not attacking Novaya. Novaya has attacked foreign agent labeling, has stood for Navalny's rights to expose corruption. So I think that is misinformed. And in fact, I think it's an attempt to divide those who stand for, press freedom, Navalny, Muratov. I will say Muratov is an extraordinary.
Seconds.
He has retained a sense of humanity and humor.
We're going to have to leave it there. Katrina Vandenhoevel, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we are joined for the full hour by Phyllis Bennis to discuss Afghanistan.
Phyllis Bennis is one of the most knowledgeable people in our movement about American imperialism and particularly what the United States has done to Afghanistan. It's a pleasure to have her.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Afghanistan had a progressive modernizing government in the 1970s. It was headed by the Afghan Communist Party, which was semi-independent of the Soviet Union. Women had the right to go to school. They did not wear burqas. They wore blue uniforms. Women had the right to a job. The infrastructure in Afghanistan was being built up with a lot of money from the Soviet Union. But the Afghan people fell victim to the Cold War against communism. The United States armed the Islamic fundamentalist Mujahideen in what became a full-scale civil war. They got help from the reactionary Pakistanis. The Afghan government invited the Soviet Union into Afghanistan. The Soviet Union got tied down in the battle and eventually withdrew. It so exhausted the Soviet Union economically and politically that by 1991, the Soviet government collapsed. President Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski, bragged about this as a great success for U.S. policy. The Taliban won the Civil War, including with a promise to end the shelling of Kabul, and came to power in Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden located himself and his al-Qaeda followers in that country. When the Twin Towers and the Pentagon were struck by al-Qaeda on 9/11, and so many people in the U.S. were paralyzed with grief and fear, the only response offered to the American people was revenge. This paved the way for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, which soon won overwhelming popular support. The U.S. government was not really interested in bringing democracy to or preserving women's rights in Afghanistan. The United States allied with the warlords of the Northern Alliance, showering them with money. Afghanistan became a tremendous supplier of heroin to the world market. Thousands of U.S. soldiers and over 150,000 Afghans died. Tens of thousands were wounded. Trillions of dollars were spent. The war was unwinnable. First, Donald Trump announced he would withdraw U.S. forces. Then Joe Biden took U.S. troops out of that country. What does the future hold for Afghanistan? We speak today with Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. wars, and U.N. issues. An expert on U.S. foreign policy, Phyllis is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Phyllis has served as an informal advisor to several top U.N. officials on Middle East issues, and was twice shortlisted to become the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. She writes and does commentary about U.S. foreign policy. Phyllis has written books about Afghanistan, the War on Terror, Iraq, Iran, Israel-Palestine, and the United Nations. She recently wrote at The Nation, "President Biden was right to withdraw U.S. troops, but we should have no illusion that this will end the war for Afghans." Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Margie.
After 20 years of occupation, the most powerful military and economic power in the world left defeated. How did this happen? Why did the Afghans give up so easily when the U.S. troops pulled out? Would you characterize the withdrawal as a victory for the Afghan people, not just for the Taliban?
Those are big questions. I think to start, I would have to say we have to look a little bit at the history of the U.S. in Afghanistan. We don't have to go all the way back and do it all, but there's a couple things that are really, really important in terms of how this U.S. part of the war is ending. The main one had to do with what the U.S. did as soon as it overthrew the Taliban-led government in 2001. It established a government, it imposed a government made up largely of Western-educated Afghan exiles who were plopped down into the country. It was like government in a box, right? We're going to create this government, put them in power, fund them, keep them in power. The problem was right from the beginning, the U.S. established a government that had nothing to do with the political traditions and the cultural traditions of the country where they were creating this government. The history of Afghanistan has never been a history of national power that's centralized in the capital. It's always been divided by tribal interests, by regional interests. The national power was always the least. The local power was always greater than the national. The U.S. either didn't know that, didn't care about it, and decided it was going to create a government that basically looked like a Western so-called democratic government with power centralized in a parliament and a president. And, of course, you know, we can look at the period where the Soviet Union was dominant in Afghanistan. They made kind of the same wrong decision, too, in both cases. But it was particularly evident when the U.S. created this mythology, which is what it was, that we're going to bring democracy, we're going to bring women's rights to the people of Afghanistan that have never had them. Well, in Kabul, to a large degree, that began to happen, just as it had when the Soviets were in control and when before the Soviets went in, when the pro-Soviet communist parties were in control. It was the same thing. What changed was limited to the cities. Women still wore burqas in the 70s, but only out in the countryside. In the cities, in Kabul, they wore miniskirts. We saw the same thing this time around, only worse because the global claims of the United States after 9/11 was that the whole world supposedly supported this new government in Afghanistan. The problem was it didn't reflect any of the interests of the vast majority of the people of the country. The government didn't represent them, and the military that was created by the U.S. didn't represent them either. You know, we heard these critiques. It was pretty outrageous, actually. We heard from President Biden, he was essentially blaming the Afghan army for refusing to fight. He almost called them cowards. It was pretty outrageous. The reality was, this was never a government that was designed to or had a vision of itself as defending the country. It was designed to protect and defend the government, this government that didn't represent the vast majority of people in the country. And as a result, the military didn't either. The 300,000 troops that we kept hearing about, to a large degree, it was completely exaggerated in numbers. There was this phenomenon known as ghost soldiers, which were thousands and thousands of soldiers whose names were on the rolls and whose commanders got money every month to pay them a salary, but who never existed in the actual military forces. So that was a part of it. The military leaders, like the political leaders, were completely enmeshed in an incredibly corrupt system that was designed that way. This notion that U.S. officials just didn't realize how corrupt it really was, that part, simply a lie. Whether they want to admit it or not, the level of corruption, which was one of the worst in the world during most of that period, was being exposed from 2009 on pretty much every quarter by the guy here in this country whose job it was to be the special inspector general for Afghan reconstruction. And his job was to expose all of this corruption. And he did a pretty good job over the years. But clearly, nobody in power in Washington wanted to hear about it. So either they didn't read his reports or they simply filed them away and said, we're really not going to deal with this. Mm. So you had a government that didn't represent people, a military that had no loyalty to the government it was supposed to be fighting for. So when the leadership fled, after months of the troops out in the field that were fighting against the Taliban, having no backup, no food in many cases, no ammunition, they said, you know, we don't need this. There's also an Afghan cultural tendency to move towards negotiated settlements rather than fighting to the finish. It's a long-standing reality that has to do with the tribal nature of the society, where tribes would often be challenging each other, fighting with each other over resources, over land, over a variety of things. And by the end, there would be a shura, a council, to sort of figure out how they were going to manage this. That's what we saw happening in city after city, town after town, where the military, the official Afghan National Army, just said, wait a minute, there's nothing here for us to be in our interest to fight these guys. These guys are Afghans too. And they would have the elders of the town would meet with the Taliban leadership in the field. They'd work out some kind of a surrender arrangement, whatever they called it, and the fighting would be over. So in many of these cases, there wasn't even a defeat by the Taliban. There was simply a standing down by the U.S.-backed forces. So finally, I think that we have to be pretty clear about what happened here. There was an extraordinary Afghan woman named Malalai Joya, who many of us in the U.S. had an opportunity to meet over the years. She ended up having to go into exile because the threats against her life were so extreme. She was the youngest member of the Afghan parliament when it was created under terms of the U.S. occupation in 2003. And one of the things that she would routinely tell everybody who she could talk to was, we have three enemies, we in civil society and we women in Afghanistan. We have three enemies right now. The Taliban is certainly our enemy. The warlords disguised as a government, they are our enemy. And the U.S. occupation is our enemy. And then she would pause and say, if you and the West can get rid of the U.S. occupation, we'd only have two. It was a very pragmatic kind of approach that recognized that getting the U.S. troops out was not going to solve the problem for Afghans, but it was going to make it much easier for them to continue their fight for human rights and for everything else that people around the world fight for.
Phyllis, the Pentagon, along with Bush, Obama, Trump, and now Biden, all knew the war was not winnable. This is demonstrated in the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Craig Whitlock's new book, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. How did they deceive the American public?
Oh, this is such an important question, Michael. You know, the book that Craig Whitlock did was based on a set, what was called the Afghanistan Papers, that were printed in the Washington Post in huge sections over the course of a week, and got enormous amounts of attention here in D.C., but almost nowhere else. And it, unfortunately, was published about 2 weeks before the pandemic hit and shut everything down. I think if the timing had been different, the impact would have been the equivalent of the Pentagon Papers in the context of the war, U.S. war in Vietnam. It was a huge level of expose, and it's great that he now has it as a book that's more accessible everywhere. But the reality is they lied. Just like they lied in Vietnam, they've lied so often. They never talked about the illegitimacy of the government they had imposed, the question of legitimacy between this imposed government and the Taliban, which, despite their cruelty and violence, had won the civil war not only militarily. They did win militarily on some level, but they also won a certain amount of support from people throughout the country in the rural areas who were not supporting the Taliban because they liked their cruelty and their really barbaric kind of violent punishments in the courts, for instance. But despite those things, because the Taliban promised and did end the fighting, it ended the shelling of Kabul that had reduced the city to rubble. And that was never acknowledged. It was always talked about in the context of specific battles. We won this battle. We took that mountainside. And you talk to so many U.S. veterans of Afghanistan who say, we never understood what the point was. We never understood what we were fighting for. In the last year, we've heard that over and over again from top commanders once they've retired from the military, who have now come public and said, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. We didn't know what we were doing. And they never talked about how the whole project of creating so-called democracy, focusing on individual freedoms, they never talked about how that was failing from the beginning, because that was never the goal. The goal was never to establish a real democracy that would represent Afghan interests. You know, keep in mind, 75% of the population of Afghanistan doesn't live in a city. They live in very isolated, very small rural areas and tiny villages. And those people gained almost nothing in terms of the much-touted freedoms that emerged in the cities. So it's true that women in Kabul, for instance, are paying the biggest price for the U.S. withdrawal. There's no doubt about that. They're going to lose a lot because they had gained these artificially imposed rights that never took into account what changed and didn't change within the country in terms of the culture and the politics of Afghans themselves. So it was easy to sort of convince people that, well, we must be winning because, look, now, unlike under the Taliban, there are women professors and there are women in the parliament, because there were guarantees written into the U.S. drafted constitution that guaranteed a certain number of seats for women. But if you looked at what was happening to women in the rest of the country, one of the things that was so noticeable was that when the Taliban was in control, Afghanistan was the worst place in the world. It was number one in infant mortality, where children would die before the age of one more than anywhere else in the world. After 20 years of U.S. war and occupation, Afghanistan is still number one in infant mortality. It's still the worst place in the world for a child to be born and survive to her first birthday. So that speaks to what these so-called rights were all about. They were important rights for a small, very small sector of the Afghan society. And I don't want to minimize that at all. It's a hugely important reality that there are now women who are getting an education and who have gone to university and become doctors and become lawyers and judges. And it's horrifying what is happening to the judges and the lawyers among them. But it's also true that the U.S. did not transform Afghanistan. It did not build a democratic new society. It imposed certain kinds of rights, which, thankfully, a number of young Afghan women were able to take advantage of. And they've been brilliant and brave. And hopefully they can at some point go back and use those skills to rebuild their country. But for the vast majority of the population, that simply wasn't true, and we were never told that. The journalists tended to only talk to Afghans in the cities, in Kabul, those who spoke English. So inevitably, the image that was broadcast across this country was that the U.S. was fighting the good fight. When President Obama was running for president the first time, remember, he talked about ending the dumb war in Iraq. He supported what he called the good war in Afghanistan, and he made clear he was going to escalate in Afghanistan. I think some people were sort of stunned when he did, because they thought of him as the anti-war president. He was not at all an anti-war president. He was against one particular war.
Phyllis, why did the George W. Bush administration invade Afghanistan in the first place?
Oof. You know, Afghanistan was never supposed to be the main response to 9/11. 9/11 was seen instantly when it happened as a great opportunity for the warmongers in the Bush administration. And I think they saw the ability to go to war in Iraq in a whole new way at that point. Afghanistan was kind of a sideline. It was the way of focusing U.S. revenge. You know, there was a lot of talk at the time, and it's continued, really, that the American people demanded war. People would have been satisfied with nothing less. I actually don't think that's true. I don't think it's true at all. I think that at the time of 9/11, the response across the country, especially here in D.C. and in New York, where the attacks were the most immediate, the sense of fear led to a level of paralysis that I had certainly never seen before, and that I don't know that anybody alive in this country had seen. We had never experienced, people in this country had never experienced that kind of an attack on our soil at such a scale. It was terrifying, and people were terrified. and would have followed any kind of leadership. There was a real danger, I think, of straight-up fascism at the time. I think people would have followed even that. What we got was a call to war. We were told it was about justice, but it was actually about revenge. At IPS, we issued a public statement with hundreds of sign-on, of signatures, that was called Justice, Not Vengeance. But what we got was the opposite of that. We got vengeance. We didn't get justice. It legitimized the idea that war is an appropriate response to this enormous crime that had happened. It reasserted the role of the United States as the military superpower of the world. I do think there's sometimes you hear people saying, well, there's also the resource question. You know, Afghanistan has more lithium than anywhere else in the world, and it has these rare earth minerals and gems. I don't think that was the reason, any more than tin and tungsten and rubber were the reasons that the U.S. went to war in Vietnam. That was a factor that was later taken advantage of to a small degree, but it wasn't the point. It wasn't the reason. The reason had to do with preparing people in this country to go to war against Iraq. So it was, even from the beginning, a kind of sideline of what the wars would be.
Phyllis Bennis, Biden promised that despite the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the United States counterterrorism would continue. What does this mean?
Well, it means fundamentally the U.S. war in Afghanistan is not completely over. They're using this notion of what they call over-the-horizon attacks using drones, which of course represents a whole other level of danger in terms of civilian casualties. We know that drones have enormously higher rates of killing civilians than the so-called targets, even on those rare occasions when the target is an actual military target. It's far more likely that a drone attack is going to kill the civilians in the area than it is the person or persons on the list. But in this case, it's going to be even worse because there's no intelligence agents on the ground to provide any kind of serious information about who's where and who's who. So we see things like that final U.S. drone attack, the last U.S. attack in Afghanistan, as the evacuation from the airport was winding down and there was that horrific attack that we were told was I forgot the word that one of the generals used, that it was a glorious attack or it was a perfect attack. He used some word of praise and said that the only people killed were from ISIS-K, and there were no civilians killed, and it was an over-the-horizon attack that proves it can work. And I remember thinking at the time, I'm not convinced that any one of those claims is true. And as it turned out, all three of them were lies. It was not an over-the-horizon attack. It was a local attack. It was not targeting an ISIS-K militant. It was targeting a man who worked for a U.S.-based aid organization that dealt with providing education and food to children, who was bringing home water for his family. And all the people killed were civilians. 7 of the 10 of them were children, as young as 2. So this was the horrific ending of a horrific war. And I think that making the claim that we're going to continue to see this kind of bombing and drone strikes is a very dangerous possibility that we really need to maintain a mobilization against to prevent that. It just means more Afghan civilians are going to die at U.S. hands.
What kind of financial pressure is the U.S. putting on Afghanistan? For example, $7 billion in Afghan reserves held by the New York Federal Reserve Bank were frozen by Biden on August the 7th. Half the population in Afghanistan is under the age of 18. They are facing famine and starvation. Talk about this situation.
This is a hugely important challenge that we face. The assets freeze, the imposition of sanctions on the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. The U.S. is still claiming that economic sanctions that lead to massive levels of illness and death, particularly among the most vulnerable, which means children and old people, that somehow those sanctions represent an alternative to war. The reality is that economic sanctions are a weapon of war, and they need to be understood as such. Afghanistan remains one of the poorest countries in the world. That was true before 9/11 and before the U.S. Invasion, and after 20 years of occupation, it's still one of the poorest countries in the world. And the notion that U.S. actions, whether it's the maintaining of frozen assets, whether it's the imposition of new sanctions, is going to somehow help the people of Afghanistan is simply backwards. This makes everything worse for ordinary people. It makes the risk of starvation desperately more likely. It means that the possibilities of a healthy society emerging out of this 20 years of death and destruction is far less likely, and it means that Afghanistan will remain one of the poorest countries in the world. Right now, the UN emergency agencies are saying that Afghanistan is weeks away from a massive humanitarian crisis as winter begins to come. Planes are unable to fly after the snows begin in November usually. And it means that particularly in rural areas, far from the cities, far from the centers of urban life, where the majority of Afghans live, the access to food is going to become a huge challenge. And when the U.S. holds back money that's designed to help people, one of the latest moves by the U.S., I don't know the exact date, I think it was at the end of August, was to make sure that the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which was about to issue a $450 million loan, it's a tiny pittance, specifically for vaccines in Afghanistan, that is now frozen at the behest of the United States, so that the government in Afghanistan, now under the control of the Taliban, cannot get it. So whoever is in control of the government is unable to provide vaccines for virtually anyone in the country, and the dangers of a skyrocketing level of COVID cases emerging. We haven't seen it yet, but it's quite likely there will be no way to answer it if that money is withheld. So the question of economic pressure sounds good in terms of, well, we'll keep the pressure on so that they, whatever, they release prisoners or they start granting rights to women. It has never worked like that in any country. In every country where economic sanctions were used as an instrument of war, as they are here, the result is the opposite. And you see governments protecting themselves and protecting their military forces and letting people starve. I don't anticipate that the Taliban government would be any different than that.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Are there parallels with the U.S. defeat in Vietnam? Why couldn't the U.S. win in Vietnam or in Afghanistan?
Ooh, that's a really hard question. I mean, that's what books have been written about. Why couldn't the U.S. win in Vietnam? It has to do with what they were fighting for, who they were fighting against. The situations are quite different in many ways, but there are some similarities. I think in both countries, both in Vietnam and in Afghanistan, countries which had been at war both with outside powers and as a venue for other powers to be fighting each other, for decades, for generations, for hundreds of years in both situations, in both cases. Afghanistan was known as the graveyard of empires. Vietnam, in many ways, was a graveyard of empires, although it didn't hold the pride of place for the saying. In both countries, opposition to foreign occupation of their land, whether it was to the nation, as was true in Vietnam, or to the region, the tribal area, the community, as it was more relevant in Afghanistan, was true in both. The nature of the so-called enemy of the United States in both cases were largely guerrilla forces that did not have a straight-up army with major access to bombers and tanks and all of that. In Vietnam, there was a more established army in North Vietnam who backed up the National Liberation Front in the South. But it was a very different kind of war that the U.S. military was not prepared to fight, as was the case in Afghanistan, where you have this massive army dependent on tanks and armored personnel carriers who moved in huge armored convoys and were vulnerable to the hit-and-run kind of tactics of a guerrilla force, which is what they faced in Afghanistan. But there are real differences as well. I think we have to be very clear about it. In Vietnam, the question of social mobilization of the whole society was a key component of the fight back against this occupation, more similar in some ways to the mobilization, for example, in South Africa, where the military fight was not the primary component, but national mobilization of the population, the black population in that case, was a key weapon in that war against the apartheid regime. Here in Vietnam, the social mobilization was the same. In Afghanistan, that was a very different situation. That was a very different reality. The Taliban had not mobilized the society on their side. They were seen as fighting back against the foreign occupiers, and they won a certain amount of support for that. But so there's differences. But I think in both cases, what you had was the almost inevitable failure of a standard huge military force fighting against an indigenous population's military. In Afghanistan, whatever else they were and are, the vast majority of the Taliban are Afghans. Their families are there. They're not a foreign force invading another country halfway around the world, as was the case for the United States in Afghanistan or in Vietnam. So in that sense, I think there is a parallel between the two.
Phyllis, you touched on this earlier, but did the Taliban's policies on women affect all women in Afghanistan? They have been organizing and demonstrating. What does the future hold for Afghan women?
I think this is a hugely important issue, not least because the question of protecting the rights of women was such a key component of how the U.S. built public support in this country for the war in Afghanistan. We have to go to war in Afghanistan to protect the women. The reality was that was never real. It was an imposed set of rights that had never been accessible in terms of the indigenous cultural development in Afghanistan. There had been struggles for women's rights. There was a women's movement that was active in the 1950s and 60s, even before the progressive pro-Soviet governments took power in Afghanistan. And they had certain gains, but again, those gains were largely limited to the cities. The real question of Afghans' women is much more a rural question. And from that vantage point, I think the answer is we don't know yet what is going to happen with the Taliban in control. So far, they have not shown enormous change from what they were like when they were ruling. But what we knew of that period of their rule, of the Taliban's rule, was very much, again, limited to the impact of their rule in the cities, where they were brutal in punishments, but had a certain amount of support in the countryside, because despite those brutal punishments, chopping off the hand of a thief, that sort of thing, there was a sense from a lot of people that, one, when they were in control, nobody was bombing their towns and villages. And number two, there was a way that things could be negotiated through councils. So the Taliban forces who would come in and try to control a town or a village had to deal with the all-male, because that was the tradition that goes back centuries in that country, the town elders, the shura, the council. And they would, in many cases, not all, in some cases the Taliban simply imposed a brutal regime by force, but in many other cases they negotiated arrangements for example, women in the healthcare world, including right now, this is what we're hearing from villages outside of the main cities. The women in healthcare are being asked to come back to their jobs, not the women who maybe are the managers of a clinic, for instance, but the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, the people with skills with patients are being asked to come back, are being protected by the Taliban. That may be a first step towards accepting the further integration of women into other parts of the workforce. But there's an extraordinary article I would urge people to read, written by the U.S.-based American journalist Anand Gopal in The New Yorker a few weeks ago, that's called something like The Other Women of Afghanistan. And he speaks Pashto. He lived in Afghanistan for some years in the past and was able, with a team of women he was working with, to get access for actual discussions and interviews with rural women across the country. And they talk about their views of what it means that the U.S. has pulled out. And it's astonishing to read for people who have thought that the position of the women who were and are, in many cases, so desperate to leave the country somehow represented all women in Afghanistan. Because what they say is, we're not so interested in what the Taliban stands for. What we're looking at is, without the U.S. troops being here, our sons, our husbands, our brothers are not being killed in U.S. bombs. That's what they knew of the U.S. presence. It was bombers in the sky, whether they were drones, whether they were fully autonomous drones or drones that were managed from these long-distance pilots based on a military base outside of Las Vegas who can, you know, use their joystick to bomb villages across Afghanistan and still be home in time for dinner every night. Whatever kind of drones, it was drones and planes that have been killing their men, killing the brothers and the sons and the fathers. And they said, that's what we wanted to end, and now that has ended, so we're happy about that. The question of wearing burqas was never on their agenda because that's a long-standing cultural tradition in Afghanistan that goes back way before the Taliban ever came to power. People actually, during the Soviet years, women in the countryside wore burqas then too. It was just in Kabul that they didn't. So, you know, this question of what it's going to mean for women, I think we still don't know, and it's going to take a while. They still don't have a real government functioning. They've appointed a couple people in the top positions. I was talking yesterday to colleagues who have friends who work in Afghanistan, some, both internationals and Afghans in a variety of aid organizations, and they're worried. They don't know what's happening, but they're preparing to go back, those who left the country at the time of the Taliban takeover, and their Afghan colleagues who have remained in the villages, whether it's women who are trained as midwives, whether it's medical people, they're saying that on the healthcare front, at least, there's a recognition by many of the local Taliban leaders that they need these people. These are the people who have the skills that they need. Whether that plays out over time in a way that actually can build a more representative level of government at the national level, we just don't know yet. How much of it will depend on the particularities of each village or each town or each region's shura, who are the forces in the local area, what are the local leadership like that are not the Taliban, because we should keep in mind that the kind of misogyny that the Taliban is rightfully so well known for is only one small step worse than the kind of misogyny that characterized a host of these warlords that were fighting against the Taliban in the war from the 1970s right through until 1996, when the Taliban finally won the civil war. Their position on women was never much better. The guy who invented the very creative tactic of throwing acid in the face of young women who had the temerity to say they wanted the right to get an education was not from the Taliban. He was a guy named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was from the original U.S.-backed Mujahideen in the 70s, was one of the ones welcomed by Ronald Reagan as the forefathers of the new Afghanistan, as he liked to call them. And he was circling around the government at that time, and he's now back as a pro-government official before the Taliban's takeover. So these are the people who the U.S. has been backing. Their record on women's rights is almost as horrific as that of the Taliban itself. So how much better is it going to be? We just don't know yet. I'm not terribly optimistic in the short term, but I think in the medium term, the one thing that's going to be very different than when the Taliban was in power 20 years ago is that the world has changed. There was an extraordinary photograph of the Taliban fighters who took over the presidential palace in Kabul on that day when they marched into Kabul. And if you look at the picture of them surrounding the desk that belonged to the Afghan president who had fled the country, half of them are carrying their cell phones. They're taking selfies. That never existed before. And that's going to change everything.
Phyllis, what should the U.S. do about Afghanistan now?
Well, I think we should start by making good on our commitments to the people of Afghanistan. That means right now our commitments to the refugees who have come here and those who are still in Afghanistan who want to leave, who we made commitments to. We owe an enormous debt to those people to help them get out and to help them rebuild their lives, whether it's here in the U.S. or wherever in the rest of the world. And we need to maintain the commitments that our 20 years of war implies to the people that remain in Afghanistan, the 40 million or so people who have not fled, are not planning to flee, don't have any way to flee, don't have any ties to the U.S. military or anybody else that would allow them to flee, who are still living in the same country. And we owe them an enormous debt because of the destruction of that country that we have been responsible for. So we owe reparations. We owe compensation. So equally with what we owe to the new exiles and refugees, people seeking asylum, we owe a huge debt to those people. And we owe an enormous debt to the people who remain. We do not owe further war and occupation. We do not owe drones coming in from, quote, over the horizon to attack Afghanistan. We owe an end to that, and we owe compensation and reparations and the help to rebuild their lives and their country.
The USA, first and foremost, suffered a political defeat. But has the military-industrial complex been transformed as a controlling force in U.S. politics? Please talk about its threat to China.
Well, this was certainly a political defeat. I think the military-industrial complex remains an enormous force in U.S. politics, as it has since the end of World War II. But I'm not sure it's a controlling force. What we're hearing right now from the top generals, the Secretary of Defense, and the other top military brass that are testifying before both the House and the Senate about particularly the withdrawal from Afghanistan, but about the war as well and the decision to withdraw the troops, we're hearing that they were not in control. The generals, as has been true for 20 years, this current crop of generals, wanted to keep troops in Afghanistan forever. They wanted to keep the 2,500 that were there when Biden took over, and they said, well, maybe there should be about 5,000 or maybe a little more than that. But they wanted to keep thousands of troops in Afghanistan forever. So when Biden made the decision, which I think was absolutely the right decision, despite problems in how the withdrawal happened, the decision to withdraw was the right decision. The military did not want to make that decision, but they were clearly not controlling. It was the White House that made that decision, and I think we should be grateful that we were not seeing a military coup in that context of the generals refusing that order. To the contrary, this was very well done in terms of generals who clearly disagreed with it, but recognized that their obligation to the Constitution meant that when the president said we are pulling out, that meant we're pulling out. The question of what happens with China is an enormous and complicated one. I think that one of the things that we have to be very clear about is that the shift to a military focus against China and the buildup of anti-Chinese propaganda in the U.S., which includes both racist escalation of violence against Asian Americans in this country, but also the question of how the people in the U.S. are coming to view China as a country, as a government, as the enemy. I mean, it's been a really intense effort to portray China as the threat to people in the United States. And among other things, while we challenge that, and we must challenge that, while criticizing appropriately China's own human rights violations, which are legion, as are our own, we also have to recognize that the question of escalating threats to China, sending more troops, more boats, more submarines, more ships, more aircraft carriers to the South China Sea, escalating military aid to the Philippines and Vietnam and other countries in the area to undermine Chinese influence in its own backyard. While that goes on, the U.S. is not ending the so-called global war on terror. U.S. bombings, U.S. drone strikes, and indeed U.S. special forces and other troops are still operating in countries across the world. There have been attacks recently in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Niger, in a number of other countries. And the U.S. military capacity and the strength of its military-industrial complex means that those attacks can continue without having to be pulled back in order to escalate against China. They can do both, and that's very, very dangerous, because as the impact of the escalation against China takes hold, and as we start hearing more and more about it, we're hearing less and less about what U.S. troops and U.S. drones and U.S. bombs are doing in these other countries. And when we don't hear about it, we don't have movements that can fight against it. And movements to fight against these wars is exactly what we need.
Phyllis Venice, we're unfortunately running down the clock here. We're coming to an end of our allotted time. I wanted to ask you briefly your final thoughts, and then how can people access your work?
It's really important that we understand that our obligations to the people of Afghanistan have not ended with the end of the military assault. We owe a huge debt. So people in this country who are involved with movements, whether it's the anti-war movements, the climate justice movement, the racial justice movement, the movement for immigrant rights, the women's movement, all of those movements, we should all be taking very seriously the need to support the refugees and other migrants coming from Afghanistan, as we support the rights of migrants and asylum seekers coming from Haiti and elsewhere. In all of those cases, we also need to make sure that there is money that goes from the enormous bloated military budget, which this year is $740 billion, almost $1 trillion just this year for the military. Parts of that money need to be taken out of the military budget and put into supporting, whether it's immediate emergency aid, humanitarian aid, development money, to start paying back what we owe to the people of Afghanistan, as what we owe to the people of Iraq, the countries that we have destroyed. We owe an enormous debt. We are not only the biggest, baddest military power in the world, we are by far the wealthiest country in the world, the wealthiest country in history. And that puts a huge obligation on all of us to build the kinds of movements that will fight for justice in this country and fight for justice globally, starting with the places where we have done such incredible damage.
Phyllis, how can people access your work?
The Institute for Policy Studies, you can go to ips-dc.org and then just look up either my name or the New Internationalism Project, and it'll get you all kinds of stuff.
Marjorie Cohen and I thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. And we look forward to speaking with you in the future, Phyllis Venice. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
Law and Disorder is adding Marjorie Cohen to our team. Heidi Boghossian and I, Michael Smith, are very glad, very honored to have Marjorie with us. She's a former criminal law defense attorney and a former professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Marjorie was the past president of the National Lawyers Guild and is a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Marjorie has published 4 books about the war on terror, and last week she was our guest discussing the situation with Professor Samuel Moyne's unprincipled attack on human rights giant Michael Ratner. She called it shameful. Marjorie Cohn, welcome as a host on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. I'm delighted to be part of the team.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By giving you no time, instead of it all, but we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home, they beat us at school. Hate us when we're clever, despise us when we're fools. Then they got us so crazy, we cannot follow their rules. Working class hero is something. They scared us 20 odd years. And then they expect you to pick a career. But we cannot function, we are so full of fear. And TV, and they make you feel clever and classless and free. Got us all still being peasants, as far as I can see. Hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling us still. First you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill, working class hero is something to be. Hero is something to be. If you want to
This is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Is black liberation possible in the United States? Not as the United States is currently configured. These are problems that we can't vote our way in or out of. These are not problems that are on the ballot. We don't get to vote on the massive redistribution of wealth and resources in this country. It really requires a different society where there's the democratic input of all of us about what our society should be and what it should look like. That can't happen in the way that this country exists now. To that extent, what I'm talking about is really a revolutionary transformation of the United States.
That's Kianga Yamata Taylor, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kianga Yamata Taylor on black liberation. The widespread protests in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor marked a new chapter in the struggle for black liberation. What would constitute black liberation? Kianga Yamata Taylor says, it's about self-determination. Can we make decisions free of economic coercion? Can we make decisions that are truly free? That, to me, is what liberation would be. She continues, I know that it's not something that black people can achieve alone. Black liberation is bound up with human liberation. On a purely mathematical basis, black people drift between 13 and 14% of the population. We can't get free alone, so this is also about really trying to examine the connections between the subjugation of black people and how that relates to a wider web of subjugation of other people, and that includes white people too. Our guest today is Kianga Yamata Taylor. She writes and speaks on black politics, social movements, and racial inequality. She's a professor of African American studies at Princeton. Her articles appear in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Guardian, and Jacobin. She's the author of Race for Profit, How We Get Free, and the award-winning from hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Kianga Yamata Taylor was in Philadelphia in mid-July. The interviewer was Michelle Alexander, Ohio State University professor and author of the bestseller The New Jim Crow. She poses the first question.
One of the themes that's most striking in your book is that it's impossible to understand Black politics and activism in America today, particularly with respect to the Obama era, without understanding the nature of the class divide that exists within Black communities. You know, in mainstream discourse, particularly within the mainstream media, when class is discussed explicitly, it's usually in the context of explaining or defending the angry white men who voted for Trump or the challenges the Democratic Party has faced in trying to appeal to less educated working class whites. But a key insight in your book is that class divisions are driving race politics. We're driving those protests to a large degree. And you write that Black economic elites have a vested interest in the notion of colorblindness and the myth that the US is basically a meritocracy and the notion that the election of Barack Obama shows that we have overcome or are overcoming. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the role of class in Black politics and activism and how the gap between the rich and poor is even more pronounced among Blacks than whites and why that matters in thinking about protest and politics then and today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the events in Ferguson, I mean, there are many events that crystallize this, but when you think about Ferguson and the way that, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus mobilized itself to go to Ferguson, and their main objective was voter registration, right? That this is, we got to get people registered and we have to vote, and that's the most important